There is In re the Estate of James and the Bank of America.
Good morning. May it please the court, Brian Hollock appearing on behalf of the estate of Alan James. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this is, while ostensibly a case related to the application of RCW 61-24080, what it fundamentally, if we're to laser focus in on the issue, is an application of RCW 26-16030, and that is essentially our contention that Bank of America did not have a valid deed at the time of the foreclosure and therefore is not a valid claimant under RCW 61-24080. The respondent, Bank of America, has provided a number of novel arguments to essentially suggest that they had a lien, it was valid the whole way through, and basically either Dorothy James or her husband, Alan James, had some obligation at some point throughout this process to affirmatively come forward and void the lien.
And not Alan, but Dorothy.
Your Honor, it's wrong for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. The main case that relies for that proposition is the Tyler distributing case, and in the Tyler case, Ms. Haynes is clearly a bad actor, and you read the opinion, it's very clear that the court doesn't want her to prevail. They want the equitable result to take place, and so they come up with this idea of it's voidable, and therefore she can't use it affirmatively to sort of get out of her own debt. And while I understand the desire to come up with sort of avoid the technical rule to come up with an equitable result.
You're assuming the technical rule is that's being avoided. Marital community, one partner takes steps that burden the community. The other partner has the ability to either accept that and allow it to continue or to challenge it.
Well, let's assume that. And that's fine. Let's assume that's the case. Then let's go straight to the facts of this. Mr. James signs the deed of trust shortly before the end of 2006. Ms. James dies January 8th, 2007.
Stop right there. Who could possibly void it at this point?
Nobody, because it hadn't been recorded. She would not have even had notice.
It shouldn't have to be recorded. She's in the hospital on a filing list. In terms of notice, I don't understand that answer. The document exists. If she's the one that has the ability to seek that it be voided and now she's dead, who possibly can seek to have it voided?
Nobody. And therefore, the onus should fall on... No, we're not, because if there was no conceivable way that she could have had notice or understand that the document existed, then she was not in a position to affirmatively come before the court and ask for relief. How are you supposed to come in before the court and ask for relief if you don't know the thing even happened?
Well, that's an answer to so many questions, but, I mean, so many other examples. That doesn't change the legal principle, which is she's the one that had the power to do it.
True, but Your Honor, if you're going to assume, then you're literally assuming that the moment Alan James signed it, she was then in the correct position to take care of it, and that means
she was the person who had the legal capacity.
She was not on notice. There was no way she could come forward. How would she have done it? I mean, how would she have done it? You yourself saying, well, she's in the hospital on her deathbed. She dies, then it falls to the estate.
But she had the capacity to change that. But once she's dead, why does the law have any interest?
Well, Your Honor,
he's He's the one now that has the resources, and he's the one who's on the hook.
Well, Bank of America had the ability to fix it from the get-go, and they're the sophisticated party. Why are we placing the burden?
You fix something that's voidable and not void.
Your Honor, if it was voidable, then the estate of Dorothy James would have been then the proper party. They don't record the deed.
Did the estate of Dorothy James do that then, assuming that that's true?
Well, here's the deal. Again, the estate of Dorothy James would not have been on constructive notice until Bank of America recorded this thing 11 months later. I'm sorry?
Her husband took it from her.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, he was on notice, right?
But, Your Honor, we're not...
You're trying to argue facts with me, but you don't get to pick which ones you want.
Your Honor, our problem...
He would have been on notice, so that argument doesn't work. So if she's dead, who can possibly raise her claim?
The estate would, but constructively it would only happen.
He didn't, and he couldn't anyway because he'd signed it.
But it wouldn't have been recorded until after the notice period had expired in the probate.
I don't understand why you think recording makes any difference
because
analyzing this issue.
Your Honor, we're not saying that Alan James did anything wrong. He's not Ms. Haynes from the Tyler case. Mr. James went and took out a loan. What we're saying here is we're trying to figure out if we're going to establish a rule in this state. If we're going to apply the rule. And what we're going to do is we're going to basically put the onus on the non-signing spouse rather than the person that really ought to be on the burden, which is the bank. They're the ones that know. Your Honor, when we do this and we try to...
Why put the bank in between the marriage?
Because the bank drafts the documents, Your Honor.
This is between the two communities?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Not when there's a statute on point.
That's why it's voidable, because the other member of the community may very well assume I don't want this.
Well, Your Honor,
this is fine. I like living in this fancier house.
If we're applying the voidable, we also have to remember that in the Tyler distributing case, the court ruled in that case that the marriage was essentially defunct. That's not the case here. There is no argument that Mr. and Ms. James didn't were in the process of getting divorced or hated each other or that this was done to hurt the other party.
It was a great marriage, and I assume he was very sad that his wife was dying. But she's the person who could have upset this transaction, and she didn't do it.
But she couldn't have had notice to do it.
Sure, she could have. He could have told her. She could have asked.
But that's
I mean, we assume that married people talk about any number of things, but I don't understand why you think the notice is important. He wouldn't have, it's unlikely that he would have told her, but it's more likely that on her deathbed she would have gone down to the auditor's office and checked her deed.
Your Honor,
reporting matters?
Well, but Your Honor, if we're going to come up with that rule, then it's going to be a hard and fast rule, and we're going to derogate from a protection that has existed in this state for 40 years to protect non-filing spouses. I will guarantee you that if you reach for that equitable result right now, what's going to happen is greedy banks are going to go and give out loans to husbands that are gamblers who are going to encumber the equity in the marital home. Wives aren't going to know about it, and you're going to put the onus on the wife to come to court and have the resources to sue the bank and ask the bank.
As long as the wife is alive, when the bank tries to get his money, the wife's going to say, hey, game over. It's voidable, and I want to void it.
Assuming she has the resources to do so.
So what may happen with the first bank that tries that, but the second and third banks will be smarter because they'll realize the first bank didn't get their money.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andrew Yates for Respondent Bank of America, who is the former junior lien holder who is properly awarded the surplus funds following the 2013 foreclosure. It's undisputed that Alan James gave a consensual security interest to secure a $115,000 loan, and his estate is now seeking to retroactively void that interest and recover a windfall. Despite the estate's efforts to the contrary, this outcome, as I think the Court appreciates, is controlled by simple application of the rule in the surplus fund statute, which is that former liens attach to the surplus in the same order that they attach to the property. The trial court's decision to award the surplus funds to Bank of America should be upheld for three key reasons. Bank of America properly perfected its deed of trust, The estate lacks standing to bring the challenges to the deed of trust's validity that it's trying to bring, but those challenges fall anyway, even if they are allowed to bring those challenges. Perfection is a simple matter that's controlled by proper recording in the county auditor's office, not by the dual signature provisions that the estate is relying on. Their perfection analysis is simply off base and not supported by the statutes or the cases. As the court has noted, at the time that Mr. James passed away, he was the sole owner of the subject property because his wife had died in January of 2007. Their interests merged either through operation of the intestacy statute, through recordation of the personal representative deed in October of 2007, but it's just undisputed that in 2011, when he passed away, he had the sole ownership interest in the property.
Well, I think the focus of the argument is when she is still alive, and what we've heard is that to conclude that the contract is voidable would be contrary to RCW 26-1603-0. What's your response to that argument?
My response is that the case law that controls is directly to the contrary. In the Taylor Distributing and Backe decisions, it's very clear that those kinds of agreements are voidable, not void. Those are well after the Campbell decision, and in those cases they actually distinguish the Campbell decision on which the estate relies. And importantly, they're very clear that the power to avoid an encumbrance or a contract that doesn't have the other spouse's signature belongs to the non-signing spouse. And here we have the estate of the signing spouse.
What about the argument that the bank had a responsibility to somehow take action to make sure that the non-signing spouse knew that this loan had been entered into?
I didn't see any authority cited for that proposition, and I'm unaware of any. And sort of from a common sense perspective, if the bank is loaning the money, it's taking the risk there. And so if it wants to write the loan documents in that way,
it knows that it only has one spouse.
Correct, or if it does or it doesn't really matter because of the community property framework that's in the background, which really was followed here and plays out under a controlling law in the bank's favor, which is exactly why the trial court's disbursement should be upheld. And the estate also talked about policy, and I'd like to touch on that too. In the cases cited in our brief, there's a very clear policy that the community property statute is there for the purpose of protecting the non-signing spouse against the word they use is improvident, but it really ill-advised substantial encumbrances or transfers of community property. And if that happens, the rule is the spouse can avoid that or they cannot avoid it. And here, neither Dorothy James nor her estate ever sought to exercise that power. And the result is really as simple as that. The purpose of these statutes is not to give the estate of the signing spouse a windfall at the expense of a legitimate lien holder that obtained a consensual security interest to secure its loan.
What's your response in the briefing to the estate's assertion that the history of amendments to RCW 26-1603-0 overrule the common law, cases like Stabbert?
Our response is essentially that because the legislature was aware of results like that, had they wanted to change the results of Stabbert or Backe or Taylor Distributing, they could have changed the statute at a point in time, but they haven't. They're presumed to be aware of those and are comfortable with the court's interpretation of that statute as is. So therefore, that reaffirms the voidable versus void rule. There's simply no basis for any of the estate's other extraneous arguments, such as that a claim in probate was required or something like that. The state simply has insurmountable standing problems, and it can't avoid application of the controlling rule. We would request the
legal matter that they have had, would the estate have come into possession of the decedent's right to see the death? I'm not talking about practicality. Does somebody go down to the auditor's office, or could they find out? I'm talking just the legal relationship.
So within the wife's probate proceeding, the representative could have sought to rescind that transaction.
Right.
No, because the wife's homestead interest, which would have been the basis for doing that, no longer exists. It merged into the husband's interest. And under cases like Upton, they're very clear that a junior lien holder's interest that attaches to surplus funds is superior to a homestead right to the surplus funds. Thank you. We would ask the court affirm the order dispersing the surplus funds to Bank of America. Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honor, as counsel literally just said about 6 minutes ago, simple recording is what's required to perfect. They didn't record until September 6, 2007. That's the day they became a junior creditor. And as a result, they can't rely on the exception to the probate statute claim requirement. The statute requires that you either provide a claim or your claim is waived, the exception being if you are a secured creditor. They didn't become a secured creditor until September 6, 2007. Ms. James dies January 2007. The probate's opened March 2007. The claim bar date expires July 2007. At that point, there was no secured interest. In fact, Mr. James at that point could have sold the property without paying Bank of America. He could have given himself the personal representative's deed and sold the property because they had not recorded the deed yet. They're operating as if the day that he signed it was the day that it perfected, and then come before this court and go, well, as long as we're recorded, then we're a perfected lien. The date is critical. They didn't become a perfected lien until September of 2007.
There's a difference between the contract and the contract right of the property on the one hand, and on the other hand, where you are in line.
Correct.
And we're using the word perfected.
We're saying... Correct. And they didn't become in line until they recorded their deed of trust. The claim, the promissory note is irrelevant. We are not making a claim on the promissory note. In fact, we're not even arguing.
So I'm not following why that matters.
Because, Your Honor, let's assume for a moment that Ms. James did have the right to object to the claim and avoid the lien. They didn't record it until the notice period and the probate had expired. They didn't record this thing until 11 months after it was signed. They didn't record this thing until 9 months after she died.
Yeah.
So there was nothing for her to void.
I'm sure there was. The legal effect of the document.
The document didn't have...
She's not voiding their place in line. That's not what we're talking about with void and voidable. We're talking about the legal effect of the document, whether the loan has to be repaid, whether there's an interest in the land.
But
not what the priority is of the interest of the land.
But RCW 61-2400 doesn't care about the loan and the promissory note. It cares about the lien right. And the lien right is what is critical. If we bypass this and we conflate those two issues, we're absolutely missing the point. The point is, did they have a valid lien on the day of the foreclosure? And we're arguing they didn't. They couldn't possibly have had one.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
That concludes our calendar.